You are listening to the Navigating Adult ADHD podcast, where it's all about education, support, and coaching for adults with ADHD. I'm your host, Zena, a late diagnosed ADHDer, here to help you unpack the challenges, frustrations, and the positive side of living with ADHD. With my no BS approach, I'll help you to better understand your unique ADHD brain and how you can work with it to feel better, increase your self-confidence, improve your relationships, and ultimately achieve your goals. Hello, my friends. The long-awaited episode on hormones, perimenopause, and all things ADHD is finally here, and I am so excited for you guys to hear this conversation with our guest, expert, and medical professional who is incredibly knowledgeable and was so willing to hang out for such a long time and answer all of the questions that we have. But before you dive into that, I need you to know that she mentions so many resources and, you know, links and websites and all the things in this episode. So I've made it super simple. You can get a PDF download with every single one of the resources that she mentions. You can get that. It's in the episode link wherever you're listening to this. It's in the bottom. Scroll to the bottom of the little episode intro that tells you what it's about, and you will find a link to that PDF. You literally click on it, bang, it'll open the PDF. It's not asking you for an email or anything, okay? Super easy. If you struggle to find that, you can head over to my website, zenajones.com, head to the podcast tab, find this episode, number 54. Right at the top there, you will find a link to that PDF with every single one of the resources that she mentions in this episode. Okay, enjoy listening to this incredible conversation and learning all the things from our expert Samantha today. Hey everybody, welcome back to Navigating Adult ADHD, where today we are joined by Dr. Samantha Newman, aka the female GP, who is a neurodiversity affirming clinician. And I found something on her website, which I'm going to share with you all, because I think this beautifully describes her and her work in the world, which is, it's her goal to make knowledge about women's health relevant, applicable, and accessible for the wahine of Aotearoa. Welcome, Samantha, and thank you so much for coming today.
Kia ora, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Yay. When it comes to women with ADHD, as we know, there is very little information available when it comes to hormones, perimenopause, menopause, and how all of that impacts our ADHD and what we can do about it. So, like, as we were just talking about before we hit record, our goal today is really to create this episode as a resource to help these women. So as you know, we have a huge list of questions that I've tried to distill down from all of our listeners, et cetera. And I've added a few of my own in there as well. So shall we start?
Yeah, fire away. Yes. Let's do it.
Yes. All right. First one is, how do our hormones affect our ADHD?
Okay. So I thought about how to answer this in a constructive way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of going to break it down a little bit. There's not much data on it, and I think for a lot of the concepts of women's health and hormones and neurodiversity, actually we have to fragment where we get our information from. So kind of quite a bit of what I say is often an assimilation of what I see with each of the different kind of diagnostic spaces. So I think in the first instance we need to know what are hormones, right? So hormones are molecules, proteins that go from one area of the body to another area of the body to control something. Mm-hmm. And some hormones are released, for example, from the brain, and then they go to an organ, for example, the thyroid. And then the thyroid releases the active hormone, which then goes and does its stuff around the body. Mm-hmm. So it can be a little bit complicated, but I thought I'd kind of talk us through the menstrual cycle and bring together some of what we might experience and the hormones do to kind of help build on that.
Does that sound all right? Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So if we focus on the reproductive hormones. So I tend to, the reproductive hormones are estrogen, progesterone, and I'm not forgetting about testosterone. And also the brain hormones, so FSH, which is follicle stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone. And I always say to, whenever I'm explaining this to my patients, my aim is for you not to remember any of these names at all. But what I
Thank
want to
you.
do is create you a little bit of a framework so you then know where you can go and where your symptoms may be significant.
Yeah, okay.
And actually, I can, on my website, I have a drawing of the menstrual cycle. So often, what I'm doing in consults is I have this in front of me because I'm a pretty visual person. So I'm drawing it as I go along at the same time on this kind of roadmap.
Yeah, so we can link to that as well so people can
Perfect.
see that visual
Yeah.
as they listen, which would be really
Awesome.
helpful. Yeah.
Brilliant. So, menstrual cycle. And I apologize to the hardcore scientists and science teachers out there, but this is kind of my version of the menstrual cycle, which makes sense in my brain and how I kind of build on it clinically. So, beginning of the month, day one, that's when we start bleeding. That's known as the first day of the menstrual cycle. And it's the first day of proper bleeding. You might have a little bit of spotting before, but that's not generally when your period starts. It's day one of full flow. And at that point in the menstrual cycle, our hormones are all low. And I'm going to focus just on estrogen and progesterone. So we've got the foundations, then we can build on that. So estrogen and progesterone are low at that point. And this is also called the follicular phase. Once again, you don't need to remember the names. I'll tell you the names you have to remember. So follicular phase, hormones are low. Throughout the follicular phase, estrogen starts to rise and it peaks and then we ovulate. And estrogen drops just before ovulation, supporting this ovulation. There are other things involved. So once again, don't criticize my science. We're going on concepts. So estrogen's risen before ovulation and it has dropped. And then after ovulation, estrogen rises again. And this time as well, estrogen rises with progesterone. And then they both peak mid-luteal phase. And that's a really key word, the luteal phase, because a lot of our problems and challenges with our hormones happen in the luteal phase. And then after mid-luteal phase, both of our hormones drop. And then generally at about day 28, but normal is day 21 to day 35, and within 5 days variation, that's a normal menstrual cycle in women over 25, maybe a little bit earlier. So yeah, in summary, my brain works in 28 days, so you've got to work with me on 28 days.
Yep,
28
cool.
days, estrogen peaks about in the middle, and it drops, and then it rises again and brings progesterone with it, and then they both drop, and that causes menstruation. Okay?
So just so I can recap, day one is
Yep.
when we start bleeding, and that is where our hormones are at the all-time low. So that's the estrogen, the progesterone, they're low. But then in the middle, so after that period of time, sorry,
About a
on day
week or so.
one,
Yep.
yeah, estrogen
Is
slowly
low.
starts to rise. But day 14, right in the middle, roughly, if we,
Estrogen's just peaked before that.
yeah, so estrogen has just peaked. Then we ovulate, and then we notice there's that drop
Sorry, the
again.
drop just before ovulation. So the
Just
estrogen
before.
peaks and drops, and then we ovulate. So it kind of is kind of, it peaks and we ovulate, and so it's dropping really quickly afterwards. So a slower incline and then a quicker drop.
A quick drop. And then is there something that happens between kind of that day 14 to day 28? Is there something else that happens in
So
there?
that's the luteal phase. So that's the really key point where a lot of women experience challenges. So, and in that time of the month, in summary, estrogen rises again and drops. And when we ovulate, progesterone rises and drops as well. Okay, so you've got in a month, the first 2 weeks are called the low hormone phase, and you've just got estrogen predominantly changing. And in the second 2 weeks, it's called the high hormone phase because you've got more hormones and more change.
And that's like what you're saying. I heard you say is that's when we experience often the most challenges is when, so from the period of time, like I keep saying period, which is probably not a good choice of words right now. I get that because it could be confusing. But from when our estrogen starts to drop at day 14 or just before that, that is when we start to notice those challenges.
Yeah, and it's variable here. And so if we then talk a little bit about the luteal phase, before we talk about that, we need to know what the hormones are doing. So estrogen is what we call it's a growth hormone in essence,
mm-hmm.
And it's a real positive hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So when estrogen rises pre-ovulation, this is the time of the month where our brains work better, our memories are better, we form more muscle, we have less cravings, we sleep better, and we need less sleep. So for me, this is the time of the month where if you're an exerciser, if movement fills your cup, this is where you push it. This is where if your motivation's down, you don't let yourself get away with it because you'll feel really good afterwards.
Yeah.
It's also where if you're training with your menstrual cycle, where you'll get the most gains with your muscle development.
Mm.
And it makes sense evolution-wise because we need to have sperm for the egg at ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have got more energy, more motivation, you want to be more socially engaged, you're not as sensory aware, then actually this is the time to set you up to reproduce.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
It makes sense,
yeah,
eh?
Totally, yeah.
And so then in the luteal phase, we'll talk a bit more about the estrogen symptoms of ovulation in one of the coming up questions.
Yeah.
But I think for the moment, in the luteal phase, this is when I think experiences are often really different.
Mm.
So if you look at, if we break down again what our hormones are doing, so estrogen is causing the womb lining to thicken to be mm-hmm. able to make a bed for baby. And then progesterone is consolidating that, making it a really nice bed. So mm-hmm. you may feel a sense of heaviness in your tummy, particularly when those levels kind of are going to their peak.
Mm-hmm.
Progesterone is a calming hormone
mm-hmm.
and it dilates, it slows things down. It affects the GABAergic pathway, which is the calming and inhibitory pathway.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, actually they feel more calm and maybe a bit more sedate, and that can have positive impact or it can have negative impact as well. Progesterone does make you sleep more and want to crave carbohydrates. And then if we go mm-hmm. back to evolutionary, how's that beneficial? Because our body's preparing for a pregnancy.
Yeah.
So actually, we need that extra carbohydrate then. And so when we go onto our questions down the line and talk about the lifestyle, we'll come back to what are our hormones doing at this different stages to what are our needs.
Yeah.
And I think the key take home from this of how our hormones affect our ADHD is that, the next step is, what else does estrogen do? So estrogen affects serotonin and it affects mm-hmm. dopamine.
Yeah, both.
So therefore, mm-hmm. we're going to be noticing more motivation, da 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 da, at the points where estrogen's rising.
Mm.
So these may be pre-ovulation and mid-luteal.
Mm.
And so then when estrogen drops, that can change. With ADHD, one of the symptoms is often kind of, more of an interoception, so kind of having those feelings in our body. So we may be more aware when our estrogen levels are higher of our heart rate going a bit quicker, of some palpitations.
Yeah.
And then with respect to progesterone, progesterone dilates, so it lowers our blood pressure a little bit. So we might feel a little bit dizzier when we stand up. And I know there'll be a group of our Wahine who have things like POTS and Ehlers-Danlos. And so often their symptoms can be a little bit more pronounced when the progesterone levels have maybe come up and also when they're going down. But I think what my big take home message from what I've learned from all of the women I've spoken to and my patients and talking to colleagues is that the individual experience is so unique.
Yeah.
And it's about, I think, having that construct of what is the menstrual cycle and then adding on your experiences, because
yes.
we've got that basic, that kind of foundation. But as soon as you put stress in the mix, actually, we don't make as much progesterone. As soon as you don't ovulate, you don't make any progesterone. So there's so many variables.
Mm.
And also, if we've been really stressed, our follicle development, so what leads to ovulation, often happens 3 months before, because it takes 3 months. So our stress response may only be seen in our menstrual cycle and our menstrual experience 3 months down the line.
Yeah.
So I think like exercise, we talk about routines, and actually routines are really bloody hard, but actually when you apply the concept of consistency, so a consistent awareness of your menstrual cycle means if you have 1 month where you don't know, it doesn't necessarily matter. But actually, it's about that kind of, you know, 3, 6, 12 months, like often with exercise as well.
One of the things I've started doing recently is really trying to track it, and in doing that, I have started to see so many patterns. Like the week before my period, my energy is less. I'm starting to get quite irritable. Like my ADHD medication doesn't work quite as well. Like my symptoms seem to be increasing, less motivation, all of that. And then when my period comes, like sometimes it gets better, but sometimes not as quickly as I would have thought. Like it's very interesting to kind of pay attention to that. And I like hearing that because I know that there is this like kind of week where I know I'm on fire. Like, and that is a week I want to do like all the things. And then sometimes there's like a wobble in the middle. And then there's usually like another bit where I'm kind of like, I feel on fire again. And then I'm leading up to my period. And I kind of hear through what you've said, and I've kind of like drawn my own little visual picture here. Like I can really see how that now makes sense.
And it's a and so that's why it's amazing for me, because I think that actually if we go back to the science, and like everybody says to me, like, oh, you do too much, or like, how have you ended up doing all of this? But when I go back to my learning journey, like when I was 16, I spent some time at a haemophilia center doing a project on menstrual bleeding. And then I spent like did my undergrad as part of my medical degree in neuroscience. And then all of my, like, sound like a complete geek, like scholarshipy stuff was all in neurology. So it all relates back to, and then I started training in obs and gynae, so it all relates back to women's health. And actually that's where we just need to do, just like applying the layers and kind of chipping away at it. I can't remember what I initially was kind of, there was a really good point for that. It's kind of gone.
I love that. I love that because
Yeah.
that happens all the time when we're recording these episodes. I love it. Well, let's move to the next question, which is how do we know if it's ADHD or if it's perimenopause? And I want to just add to that question that the majority of women are diagnosed, from 35 onwards, and that is, according to the studies and the research, because our hormones are beginning to change. So how do we know if it's ADHD or perimenopause? I'd love to hear.
So I'm going to say I'm really pro appropriate diagnoses of ADHD. But I think there is almost, there's an ADHD that manifests at perimenopause or later in life. And I think there is a separate ADHD symptoms of hormonal changes in perimenopause. So, actually, if we look at what the brain changes are at perimenopause and hormones, so we go back to kind of our menstrual cycle. So in perimenopause, what happens is, the start of the month, our hormones are low. The hormone telling our ovary to release an egg is follicle stimulating hormone. But in perimenopause, the ovary's getting a little bit tired. So it's just trying to have a little snooze. So FSH has to shout and FSH rises. And then eventually estrogen kicks in and it shouts really, really loudly and really quickly. So suddenly you have a huge change in estrogen and it's telling you it's there. So this is often why you can get more pronounced symptoms. And then it drops, and what come up has to come down. And then again, it happens again. And you often have lower progesterone. So when we look at what estrogen does, it does help with memory, attention, problem solving, keeps us focused, keeps us maintaining our train of thoughts with name recall. So even if you just look absolutely at the science, it makes sense that symptoms of ADHD, also kind of overlapping with brain fog, become more pronounced when your hormones change.
Because so many of the symptoms are the same.
Overlap.
Like they
Exactly.
overlap hugely.
Exactly.
It's like so hard
Exactly.
to tell the difference. But as you said, like it's the symptoms, if it is undiagnosed ADHD, those symptoms are really enhanced with the hormone changes. So it's a mixture of both, right?
And I think that, for me as a clinician, I want to remain open-minded to that. So when I don't diagnose ADHD, but as you kind of said, like I am neurodivergent aware, in the sense also that from my own experience over the last number of years, the women that I have struggled to either gain a rapport with as much as I normally would, or struggle to improve their symptoms enough or their quality of life, or we haven't managed to get the right medications, on retrospect, they've pretty much always been neurodivergent. And some just have thought not to tell me because they don't feel it's relevant. So my big thing is I'm always like, you know, I want to know that, like, we can work with this. This is really cool if I can, like, know this information. But also, you know, setting women up to succeed in that we don't necessarily need a diagnosis, particularly initially, if we know what we're kind of what we're managing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I kind of like to look at the science and understand it. But I think, so for me, I'm just going to say when diagnosing, I don't do it. That was what kind of my workaround, is that I look at, you know, what happened. I don't diagnose it, but I don't think I would ask for your mum's history and aunts and stuff and school reports. But I don't have to be medically safe because I don't do it.
Yeah.
But for me, does that make sense? So
yeah.
But in principle, I think female ADHD is often really masked. So
yes.
I think it's really hard.
Yes.
Like, I like to look back on that time journey, but it's not necessarily for me. It's, they were crazy. They were jumping out of the things, but it's the subtle stuff. Like, oh, was really chatty, or did really well until actually at kind of age 14, learning became harder because they couldn't focus as much or had to do activities after every day. I was always a bit of the weird kid. Friendship groups, like, you know, how was that? Did you feel that you fitted in? And also there's, with ADHD, there's increased rates of PMS, mental health conditions, comorbidities, anxiety,
mm-hmm.
depression,
mm-hmm.
Eating disorders, challenged and disordered eating. So then I often also, like, I think I don't need a diagnosis to be able to support women in their journey now. So I'm like, do you remember when you were at school that you took a lot of time off of school when you started your periods? And it's amazing that Wahine now that I see, and they're like, oh yeah, I was off school loads, or that's when I started my antidepressants, and that's when I started with a counsellor. So it's that little subtle thing, and I'm not saying it's definitely hormones, and I'm not definitely saying it's ADHD, but these are patterns I often see. So it helps you kind of fit those puzzles together.
Yeah.
And then another thing that's really interesting is with ADHD, often I'm quite hormone sensitive. So I was put on the pill and I hated it. You know, in my head, that's another little red flag.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
flip side is, I was so much better on the pill. Because you've always got the prior, like the real yes, you've always got a complete no as well, I think, with hormones.
Yeah,
and
yeah, we're quite extreme in that, like all or nothing, like we're down one
everything.
Extremely one way or the other quite often.
And then, you know, going on more at life, like when were the other kind of vulnerable reproductive transitions? Did you try the pill? What hormonal contraceptives have you tried? Did they work? Did they not work? What were the side effects? How was pregnancy for you? What happened to your world then? What was your job? How did you manage X, Y, and Z? And it's often those things, I think, for me, if I was to be an ADHD diagnostician, which I'm not trained in doing, I would be wanting all of those to help me figure out now to separate, is it ADHD of perimenopause or is it ADHD of life?
And to speak to that, like, I've had, as I share much of my journey very publicly, I've had a lot of women reach out to me and say, oh my god, that sounds like me, I'm experiencing so much of that. And then I'll send them often to, there's a link and I'll put it in the show notes for the ADHD New Zealand website. They've got a like a self-diagnostic tool to give you an indication if you likely have ADHD. And people will go through that and come back to me and say, oh no, I didn't tick enough boxes to pursue diagnosis. And that really got me thinking about so much of what I share is like symptoms that are also perimenopause, and we're in a similar age group. Some of these people I went to school with, right? And they may not necessarily be thinking I'm entering into perimenopause because I'm 37, I think, but I have noticed a huge and quite dramatic change in hormones, which was, of course, why, you know, the ADHD diagnosis or how that finally came about. But yeah, there's such an overlap there.
Yeah. Oh, there's a complete overlap. And I also think that, you know, what is perimenopause? We didn't even talk about that. So, you know, perimenopause, the old quote marks diagnosis was about a purely menstrual change. So change in your bleeding. One, you don't always have bleeding, another story. But actually, the cognitive changes often start 5 to 12 years before that. So suddenly this is totally normal. And this is one of the things that I'm struggling in with, I think, with some colleagues and perceptions, is that really subtlety of, okay, if you've got PMS, you're more likely for it to worsen at perimenopause, if you've got same as ADHD.
Yeah.
But also, you know, why can't you have tipped over, and what's caused that sudden change? But I think if you've managed your PMS really well for so long and not had any other actual, you know, hormonal huge decompensations, and life's good, you've got, have you got that, you know, that clarity, that confidence now? What else could have changed it?
That's a good question to ask. Like, what else is going on? Has there been something
really
else significant in your life that has happened that?
Yeah. And you know why I love that question? It's because when I see women that are like 55 and 60, I go back through the history with them, and they're like, oh yeah, well, I stopped work at 45, or I had a hysterectomy or something. And I'm like, oh. And often you can pull it back to the life change came secondary to the change in sense of self, or it was the other way around. But it's often really interesting, the amount of women I see that had burnout when suddenly their periods got heavier, their joint pains got worse, they got a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, or they may have got a diagnosis of ADHD at that time.
Yeah.
And you know, some of them, it's an appropriate diagnosis of ADHD. I'm not discrediting that. But it's really interesting. And so I think, because for me, hormones is more of a brain factor than a menstrual factor. So the period's the benchmark. The period tells you where you're at, you know, in your cycle, so you know where you are. But it's way more about this cognitive function and what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh, so many questions. Let's keep going. Are there any evidence-based strategies or treatments available for managing both the perimenopause and the ADHD symptoms together?
Well, I think I kind of alluded to that, actually. I kind of get my information from different places, and I think different things work for different people.
Mm-hmm.
One of my really big like life approaches is the whole menstrual cycle and, you know, adapting and supporting life to the menstrual cycle. Because you know, work when you feel best, have that, like, you know, that confidence, that sense of self. I always like, so when I was a kid, every school holidays, I just used to vomit. And my mum was always like, oh, she's just exhausted. She's just exhausted. But it was normal for me to just be sick every school holidays. And it just made me reflect on, why should we be pushing our children so much? And as a GP, you know, seeing mums bringing their kids, why should we be pushing our kids so much to crash at every holiday? And so why should we be doing it ourselves? And actually, we've lost that, you know, a mark of productivity in society and wellness is how productive you are, how much you achieve.
No.
So actually, that is not conducive, really, for, you know, for being healthy and well and for within the menstrual cycle. Look back at indigenous societies and, you know, actually menstruation or pre-menstruation was a time for consolidation. It was a time to go back to the land, to kind of to be with the Whenua. And that's, you know, kind of worldwide, a lot of different indigenous communities. Whereas right now, and I think that's another one, I don't want to medicalize everything, but I just want to give people the knowledge and what is normal, and that if you are challenged or struggled, or if it's affecting your quality of life, it may, in quote marks, only be knowledge that you need to feel better. But actually, there's often a lot of other options. So my biggest thing, I think, is knowledge. And I, like, once again, I've got the menstrual cycle drawings, and I have like a diagram that I started about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and I've said I still got draft on it because I haven't finished it yet. But it does the trick right now. So I've gone, like, you know, what's the diet things that can support you throughout the month? So, you know, beginning of the month, if you're doing more, you need more protein, you need to make sure you have enough carbohydrates for going, for getting to go. Then in the luteal phase, like, kind of, you know, being quite generalistic, but bowels often slow down and often get thirstier. So having some more electrolytes in your diet to maybe maintain your blood pressure, but adding some more salt onto your food can help with that fluid shift, help minimize the bloating, help prevent, so it keeps the fluid, the blood in the vein, the fluid in the veins rather than kind of going out. And it can help your poos move along, because often progesterone slows things down. And we talked about, you know, the complex carbohydrates. So we get more insulin resistance premenstrual. So we do put on more weight then. So actually adapting those things are really important. Like I'd love to write a book on this and be like, you know, break it all down of, you know, there's evidence of that we need to eat protein to build muscle. There's evidence that if we don't eat enough carbohydrates, it has an impact on ovulation. If we don't eat enough full stop, we don't ovulate. And one of the first signs is anxiety. But I think if we can break it down into the little parts of the menstrual cycle, suddenly you have an overview that you can work for you. And also that in like that internal awareness of this is okay, but actually if it goes across and this is not all right, this is like, you know, there's something wrong. But because I think like the amount of women I've seen that, you know, push it too much in the luteal phase and find they get more palpitations. This happens every month. And actually you don't need to see a cardiologist. You need to adapt lifestyle and just fuel your body a bit better, maybe get some more sleep, be aware that your anxiety manifests in palpitations. So whenever I'm working with patients, I kind of talk about like a road. And I say that for me, I always manage hormones along this road, because actually it's really, really rare that I can't actively support your hormones through lifestyle supplements, medications, hormone, non-hormonal, alongside making sure that those palpitations aren't because you've got electrolyte abnormalities or thyroid disturbance or anemia. Do you know what I mean? We can do that along the same time. Even like if I'm worried it's a heart perspective, it's rare that, you know, someone in their 30s or 40s would have, you know, ischemic heart disease. So I'm always aware of it, but often you can manage it alongside. And it's not often that you say, I can't manage your hormones now, I need to get this. So then, you know, if women are going into a GP consult, I think understanding your symptoms, but also giving space to the GP to express what their concerns are. And if you're like, I really think it's my hormones, but you know what, I'm happy for you to say you don't think it is. And I'm happy to work with you for that. But actually, this is my evidence. This is my evidence for this. So can I try something? Or, you know what? I don't want you to worry. Why? Yeah, I'm happy for you to refer me for a colonoscopy for my, you know, my monthly constipation. But that's okay, because you are trained in making sure it's nothing else. I can still understand what's going on.
Yeah, so I really hear you saying there that it's important to, like, if you're going into the GP to discuss hormones, like, keep track of things, like make notes about what time in your cycle certain things are happening, whether it is like the heart palpitations or like, you know, you're constipated or anything like that. Like, keep track of these things and pay attention to like what phase of the cycle are these sorts of things happening. Is this, you know, normal for this to be happening? And, you know, having that awareness, I think, is huge.
Definitely. But I also, I'm really mindful, because for a lot of the women with ADHD, if you don't feel well, the last thing you're going to feel like doing is keeping a diary every day, focusing on all your negative symptoms, like,
or remembering to.
Yes, exactly. So it's just, but it doesn't remember, because you're often in this like stress state. So I think then when I'm like, you know, what information is useful for me to know to be able to help? And actually sometimes it's just a couple of things and that's enough. But then often if that's not enough and we haven't got enough pieces of the puzzle, you've then got that motivation to look for those things as well.
To start paying attention to those.
So I've got like, sometimes I use IAPMD, so the International Association of Premenstrual Disorders. I think it's on my website, but I can always send it to you. You'll just have to chase me up on it. And you go down and you can just tick what symptoms you've got. And their app's pretty good as well. But I think it's finding what is easy for you and what are your kind of recording needs and what are you going to get out of it? Because it may be actually that you can do it retrospectively of, oh, these were my symptoms. Maybe that you need a reminder. It may be that you're only going to write it down when things are really, really bad or when things are really, really good. For me, I'm like, I don't really mind as long as we can work together about it.
So one of the things that you were saying in there as well is like adapting your life to your cycle. And that's something that I have started kind of considering and being more mindful of, is like, you know, there are times where like I feel like I want to hibernate, to be honest. And then there are times where I'm like super productive and I want to do lots of things. So where possible, if we're able to do that, that obviously is one of the things that we can do to help our our symptoms and enhance our quality of life, really. Because I think one of the problems we have is that we're so obsessed with being productive and getting things done and achieving and succeeding, and we make ourselves bad or wrong if we're not doing that. And then, you know, we're continually trying to push ourselves, and obviously that's not going to help.
Yeah, and also, you know, like, what other, if you like pushing and doing stuff, what are the other positive things that can fill your cup but give you the energy too? So, you know, what is energy giving, not energy draining, at those appropriate times? Like, actually, if it gives you, if you've got enough spoons left to cook dinner, but that's a calming thing because you're an active relaxer, then do that. But if you can't, then don't think of alternative options at that point.
Yes. And as well as, like, removing the judgment for that, because, you know, like, sometimes we're like, well, I should cook dinner, or, you know, all of that. But it's like, no, like, really do listen to that. And I often say that with people that I support as well, is like, pay attention to how much dopamine you got in your tank, right? Do you have, like, when we talk about spoons, right? Do you have the spoons to do that? And if you do, it might cost you a bit of energy, but are you going to get energy back? Like, is it going to help, like, refuel you at the same time? Like, think of it like that and really pay attention to that.
And that's going to change as well. I think that's the other thing. It's going to change either monthly, and some months I think you'll feel that you're nailing it and you're like, yeah, I can do this. And actually then some months you just get it completely wrong. But I hope that with an element of consistency that you kind of get that confidence in your body back. And so a lot of the time, like, when I'm working with women when they're younger, we get things sorted. And to be honest, like, so I'm from Hawke's Bay. And a lot of women in just after the flood, in the 3-6 months after the flood, we'd managed their perimenopause and they were stable, and we'd managed their menopause and they were stable. But actually things got worse. So they knew the skills and things. And then they came back to me like, Sam, I'm worse again. But what I think I'd done is give them the confidence to be like, the world is not over. They're not back to where they were. Because honestly, often when you start to feel better with your intervention, then you've got further to fall. And you're like, oh my goodness. But actually, if you know those keys to that lock, so just look at those little benefits that that strategy has given you. Because actually, it's like with children, you think, oh my goodness, I'm an amazing mum. The naps are right. You ate my dinner. I'm just like, life's great. And then 2 seconds later, they'd like, you're like, how have I bred this? Like, what's going on?
Why are they tantruming? What did I do?
And I think hormones are the same. So you've got to, and that's with perimenopause, you know, you've got to be, we say that it's almost a second puberty because of all of the change and all of the things like that. But actually, you can be prepared for the change and can be prepared. You can have some control in the loss of control. So one of my things of making things accessible and stuff is, as a GP, we have, this is one of my dreams. As a GP, we have like a dashboard at the top, and we do like for cardiovascular risk. You know, we're paid from the government to make sure everyone's got a really good cardiovascular risk done when they're kind of in mid-life and beyond. So blood pressure, BMI, do they smoke, alcohol and that stuff. So I want a reproductive hormones and women's health one. Because when I look at that and I can see, oh, postnatal depression, counseling as a teenager, migraines or insomnia, and depending on the stages, then to me, I'm suddenly like, oh, how are you feeling? What's your menstrual cycle like? Because then I can be like, oh, here you go. Here's this resource. And I'm really happy if people say, nah, I don't need to see you now, or we don't need to explore this further. I'm like, great, perfect. But what then I'm doing is that you've got that awareness, so things change. You're not on the floor. Because I think that's what loads of the older women now I'm seeing are, is that they've had 10, 20 years of just being gaslighted and not having their symptoms validated and recognized. And then that continual suppression and stress response. And there's just nothing left in the tank. So I think that's why I think everything's being overdiagnosed at the moment, because there's an increased awareness. It's not because there's more of it. Why, like, you know, imagine in 20 years, what is the definition of women's health going to be, and women's mental health? Because actually, there was about 2 weeks, a number of months ago, I re-referred four wahine, two in younger women in their 20s and two older women in their like 40s or midlife women, 40s and 50s, to challenge their diagnoses of bipolar disorder and borderline personality. So I was like, this is hormones. You've not got bipolar disorder. And so and then recently as well, I've had a number of women who incidentally have come to see me. And this is why I'm like, I'm not a hormone doctor. I'm not a menopause doctor. I do women's health, because I thought one lady came just for like some paracetamol, And I noticed that she was at a perimenopausal age and needing sleeping tablets. And I was like, how do you feel about HRT?
Yeah.
I think about menopause. And she was like, I've got no uterus. And I was like, that's all right. I think I could get you to feel better with HRT. Do you fancy a diagnostic trial? I was like, this is a little bit out there. But actually, I've seen women with your background that have actually got much better. So what do you think about a diagnostic trial of some estrogen?
Yeah.
These are the benefits it could see, but what are the risks? You aren't working, you've got no quality of life, you feel rubbish, you're on antidepressants. What have we got? And I think that why can't we use hormones as a diagnostic trial more?
Yeah.
Particularly for women, I think, with ADHD and neurodivergence and fibromyalgia, POTS, long COVID, all of those. And I think, one thing that I think we almost haven't done well yet is, for me, when looking at kind of getting a diagnosis and appropriate management, is how we use the hormones. And I think there's a question later that you mentioned, maybe in the PMDD bit, because I think there's a number of women that have come to me and been like, HRT and hormones don't work. But I think if we find out the history, then we can make it work. And I've had a few, a number of successes in that way.
Yeah, well, when you talk about using the hormones to help us diagnose things or better understand things, first of all, that makes so much sense. And I have as well come across many women who say, I was diagnosed with, a personality disorder, but actually I really don't think that's what it is. And they've had to advocate for themselves, and eventually they get diagnosed with ADHD, which is
it's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing.
I see more and more of them. And I realized it probably about 3 years ago, when I suddenly was like, I've got a really disproportionate number of women with ADHD in my clinic. And so I went back and just reflected on that. And I was like, why have I got so many women with ADHD? And I don't think it's an equitable thing. I don't think it's because of a health-seeking behavior or they can afford more. I looked at the symptoms and how they've responded to the medicines. And I was like, it's hormones.
Yeah.
Because there's a link with hormones and ADHD.
Yeah. So that begs the question then, which I know we're skipping questions, but is there a way we can test our hormone levels and understand that? Because I know I paid a shit ton of money to do some saliva testing that was, I don't know, it made no sense to me. And then they tell me during the reading of the report that it can change drastically day to day, depending on the time of your cycle. At the time, I didn't have a period I could track. I was like, I've got no idea.
Seemed like
a big waste of money. What's the deal?
I think that if you're younger and depending on your history, they do have a role. But that is the rare cases. That's not the norm. And if you go back to our drawing of our menstrual cycle, you can see how much was changing every day. That it makes sense. But I hope that what kind of we've highlighted today is that it's about symptoms and how you feel. And actually with PMDD, so PMDD is premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So that's when, in essence, really bad PMS is affecting quality of life. And it is a psychiatric kind of diagnosis. But I don't know if you read any of the work by Dr. Tori Eisen Vidamul. She's out in America. She's just amazing. But I think, and what I see in my women is there's actually different subtypes of PMDD. Putting it really bluntly, there's a cohort who do really, really well with high dose progesterone.
Okay.
So you know that luteal phase, really, really high dose, and actually having it for the whole month, and they do really, really well. Improve pain, improve anxiety. There's another cohort that do absolutely horrifically with any form of progesterone, and they're progesterone intolerant.
So to speak to progesterone, if we were to talk in terms of pills or thing like contraceptives that people have heard of, is that what the Mirena is? I'm curious.
Okay, so if PMDD, what I find that really interesting to hang this concept of contraceptives benefits and risks on, because with PMDD, we don't really know 100% what the science is. We know some people it's because of the change in hormones, some it's because of the absolute levels. So therefore, we need to think, what could your hormones be doing at that point to exacerbate your symptoms? So therefore, what contraception do we use to support that?
So based on the individual symptoms that person with PMDD presents with, then it's
what
would be the best one?
Yeah, I think there are generalized guidelines, which actually they do have supplements first. So calcium, vitamin B6, and magnesium can help as well. So there are some supplements there. Agnes Carex as well. Then medication wise, because probably the majority of women with PMDD and hormonal sensitivities are worse following ovulation. So therefore, ovulation causes a lot of change in hormones. You want to avoid that. So a hormone such as a combined pill such as Yaz is quite effective. And that, so Yaz has higher rates of anovulation, particularly when taken for 3 months or less. So if you're not ovulating, you've got hormonal stability. So therefore, you've not got the estrogen going up and down, affecting your serotonin and your dopamine. So it can do really well. It's also the progesterone component, because if you've got estrogen, you have to be worried about the thickening of the womb, so you need a progesterone. So the progesterone in that is drosperinone, which has been shown to be nicest on the brain and better and more tolerated for women who have PMDD. So and then if you have breakthrough bleeding on Yaz, then Yasmin has a higher estrogen, and that can help with the stabilization. But estrogen affects the tummy, so some people have a bit of nausea with it. So it is a little bit of a kind of a playoff as well. Yaz and Yasmin aren't funded in New Zealand, so they're often not on a lot of GPs' radars, because I think, you know, actually GPs in principle, you know, want accessible, free care as cost-effective as possible for patients. And I think sometimes you forget to actually, I don't have the right to decide what is most cost-appropriate for my patient. I cannot assess what financial or time intervention will be best for their health. So I always present them as, you know, there are these different options. This has this benefits, risk, this, blah, blah, blah. So Yaz and Yasmin are kind of one of my go-tos. And I think, you know, from an accessible, ask WINS. Will they fund it? Write some letters. We shouldn't have to do that. Email Pharmac. We need to kind of get on to just being like, we really need this medication to be funded for our women. Whereas a lot of the other pills, the more funded ones, have all got other synthetic progesterones in, like levonorgestrel,
Is the mini pill one of them?
So the mini pill is norethisterone. So once again, that is a synthetic progesterone. So progesterone is a really unstable molecule in the body, the natural progesterone. So in the 1970s, they realized if you give estrogen only, then it thickens the lining of the womb and you get cancer. And they were like, we need to do something about this, but they couldn't make a progesterone. So they made a synthetic progestin, which is really good at controlling the bleeding. But because it's not so like our natural hormone, it affects our, it doesn't affect our brain in the way that our natural progesterone does. So it has a higher cardiac risk. Brain doesn't, often can impact the brain a little bit more, and particularly in a negative way. Weight gain, bloating, all of those things change.
Well, I had a really bad experience, and I'll share it, that I was prescribed the mini pill not that long ago, and I was taking it. I'd taken it for about 3 months, and I was sharing with a friend, like, I'm really struggling at the moment. I'm feeling really low mood. Like, I'm out of sorts. And she said, funny you should say that. I've just stopped taking my pill. And I found that as soon as I stopped taking it, within about 48 hours, I felt better. And I went, you know what? I got nothing to lose. I'm due to repeat the prescription. I haven't filled it. I'm just going to see what happens. And that was just, thankfully, she'd said that to me in passing, because that was what it was. When I stopped taking it, I started to feel myself very quickly. Within a couple of days, I was like, oh, I'm back to myself. I was like, what in the hell?
Yeah. And I think that also for me, if you'd had that conversation with me, I'd have wanted to set you up as well, because you feel it's hormonal. So, you know, a lot of the time you're right. But actually, some people have quick runoff of hormones within 48 hours. Others, to be honest, it does take a couple of weeks. So once again, if I'm doing any form of intervention with my patients, I'm like, well, actually, this may one, you might be sensitive to it, so we might start at a really low dose that's homeopathic, is going to do nothing, and we need to build up. But actually, some women are really sensitive straight away and feel it. But others, I find, do take, you know,
it
2 weeks.
It took me a while
and it takes
to
even longer to build up to it and or to come off of it.
And that's one of the things I talk about with ADHD medication as well, is like, although often your psychiatrist prescribes the first month and then you come back and, you know, talk about how it's going, like I have experienced multiple times as I've changed medications, it takes a few months to be in my system before I notice, oh, actually my mood has dropped, or my anxiety has increased, or this is, you know, whatever's happening. So that was my experience of the mini pill as well, was like, it took time for me to finally notice, actually, my mood has been low for a while now. Like, maybe there is something contributing to that.
Yeah. So do you mind if I kind of talk through, Bex, what I'd do if you were my patient and you hadn't gotten on well with norethisterone?
Yeah, please.
So in principle, if you had tried norethisterone and you hadn't liked it, I'd be finding out about your bleeding. So did you have, like, 30% of women have bothersome bleeding, 30% have no bleeding, and 30% have regular periods. So I'd be like, did you have a cyclical worsening? Because that's always a really easy clue. Generally, most people say no, and they just felt rubbish all the time. But also, ADHD and the pill, you've got to take it in 3 hours. That's hard, eh?
Wait, what? Nobody told me this.
You've got to take a mini pill in 3 hours. Otherwise, it's not effective.
In 3 hours of taking my ADHD meds? Or
within a 3 hours window every day, so it's got to be really routine.
As in the same time every day? Yeah, I knew that one, and I was trying really hard, but it was at the opposite time of day to my meds. Like, I'd take it at night, and I'd take my med in the morning kind of thing, my ADHD med in the morning.
So then the next option is Cerazep, which is a progesterone-only pill again, which once again isn't funded. So I've got some women with PMDD, neurodivergence, who are more hormone-sensitive, actually do really well with Cerazep. Cerazep is a progestin called desogestrel. So it's a synthetic one again. It has much higher rates of anovulation, and you have a 12-hour window. So from the sense of compliance, it's more got better contraceptive rates. And for some women, a higher proportion of women have no periods on it, and a significant portion don't ovulate on it as well. So some women do really well on that.
So meaning, like, am I correct in thinking then that it would be more stable hormone-wise?
Exactly. That's what I mean, sorry, by saying not ovulating. Yes, exactly.
I just put it into language. I understand. Great. No, you're all good. So as we're having this conversation, it makes me think, like, so much of what I have learned and researched around, like, you know, hormones, perimenopause, et cetera, is talking about, like, the loss of estrogen. And we're talking quite a lot about progesterone. So... This is confusing, because I know how much, like, the estrogen impacts our dopamine and serotonin levels, but, like, how do we know which one of those to we should focus on?
We don't, and that's where, like, I think one of my strengths is managing women who have tried some stuff and are not winning. Because then I, like, go down, like, a little rabbit warren of what helped and when, and those really nitty-gritty stuff of what it is. And I think that's where it comes down to that hormonal journey. What's it been throughout life? What are your symptoms? So I use the Green Climacteric score a lot, even in my kind of early, in any most reproductive cycle consultations, actually. And you can, that's on my website as well. But that basically has a list, it's validated, of estrogen symptoms, which are menopause related, but most of which are estrogen, I hate the word deficiency, but lower estrogen symptoms. And I've made an extra little column on the right, which is exacerbation premenstrual. And so for me, looking at estrogen symptoms, for a lot of women, it's, you know, anxiety, hot flushes, and vaginal dryness, loss of libido. A lot of them are low estrogen. But in the neurodivergent population, I think some of the anxiety is due to low progesterone. Some migraines are due to low progesterone, some body pains. But I think in the majority, it's estrogen related. So I'm always actually, you know, if people think it's hormones and estrogen and perimenopause, then we do go down and want hormones. Then I do go down the exploration of what symptoms are typical of estrogen deficiency, but setting people up to be like, well, in this neurodivergent spectrum, whether it's diagnosed or not, actually, if we're not winning, so that's one of the things I think that I've realized, if I'm not winning and people are well estrogenized, then then I play with the progesterone or some testosterone and things, or try different estrogen. But generally, that's probably how I approach it.
Yeah. So you've got a tool on your website where we can go through and like tick boxes to kind of indicate
it's
whether or not.
Yeah, it's like a PDF like, document.
More estrogen or, to kind of identify which kind of hormone we're likely.
Oh, it's more estrogen, but I think that's where I probably, in my mind, that's the next, like the small printy stuff. I don't know what other doctors do, but that's kind of how I approach it.
Because that could be something
that I see.
Yeah, that could be something that's quite useful to like even print out and kind of like go through so that we take it into our doctor if
Definitely,
we're going to our doctor
yes,
and
absolutely.
Say, hey, like I've had a look and this is kind of what I'm noticing. Yes, do you have any more questions? Because I think this, you know, my hormones are changing or, you know, this is what I'm seeing.
Yeah. So I'm actually writing a course at the moment for that. So
Excellent.
I've been like I'm a bit of a rambler and just like go off on tangents. And I love providing my patients with like information and that is communicable and that they can use. And the same, I do quite a lot of community education sessions. I've probably been doing it for a number of years now. And I love designing webinar pages and stuff. So I was going to write this as a book and a workbook. And then I was chatting to my web designer and told him what I wanted to do. And he was like, why don't you like make a course?
Yeah.
So I'm currently lifting from my workbook, from workshops into a course, which
awesome.
Will have kind of, my aim is to walk you through what I do to prepare patients for an appointment with a GP or in my first consultation so can understand their symptoms. It's not actually neurodivergent aware at the moment. Like, you know, it's written text, a couple of videos, but it's a stepping stone. I think for me, it's, you know, it's that first place. I'm going to make audios of it different work things and note stuff to really just support that. But it's going to start with just being like a standard kind of little walkthrough course.
Yeah.
It's so
oh,
important
fantastic.
What you're saying.
It is really important. Like to be able to, you know, advocate for ourselves and know what information to take into our GP to say, hey, this is what's going on. Like, and to have, like you've said, like the importance of having some kind of understanding and awareness, that can help, help to understand what's going on.
One of my driving factors was that when a few years ago, when I used to see patients and they come in and like for a 15-minute appointment and be like, oh, it's my hormones. Literally, I was probably really mean and I wasn't understanding. But when I reflect on, you know, when you're mean and not nice, it's generally out of fear. And it was because initially I knew what to do, but I just was like, how on earth can I do this well in 15 minutes and communicate? And you're like, you can't, particularly when you don't know someone. So that's what kind of has made me think I need to, you know, this. And actually, as a GP, they are your best person because they've got the information about your history. They know you. But I think that's why a lot of the time, like GPs don't want to explore hormones because they're so worried about missing something else. And they also, it's been mind blowing to me how much my patients, and I'm not allowed to say testimonials, which is why I need to get publishing because I'm just, it's incredible and just so humbling of people saying, you changed my life. I've got my life back. You're like, so it's really obvious to me, but I can't tell people that. So we've got to, as a community and as our women here, be able to work with our GP and then tell them how much they've made us feel better. Because as GPs, we don't have that knowledge, but we never have done. And that knowledge isn't known worldwide.
That brings up such a good point. Like I have never thought to say to my GP, like, hey, like this thing that we did together or like this change or this thing that you suggested, like that's really helped my life so much. Like I've never even thought to, and I think that that's important that we do give that feedback because then they understand and see, hey, helping these women with these issues or these hormonal things, like that is massive. And that was one of the questions that we had is like, why are more GPs not knowledgeable on this? And I've never even considered the element of fear. And like, it's such a big topic.
It really is. And that's why I think if we can change society from the bottom, so even like in schools, and I did a little bit of like market research a couple of years ago, like going into a couple of schools and chatting to some of the girls there, like even we just need to reframe the whole construct of what we're doing and how we're getting information and how we're communicating that. Because actually, I think if you go to a lot of GPs as a GP, in my general GP practice, I have most of the time been set up to fail by the system, because 15 minutes for talking about every system of the body and delivering a management plan and communicating it to you within the context of your menstrual, I can't do. But actually, if you're one of my patients and I know you and I know what your I know what your risk factors are, I know how you like to communicate, we've got a portal, I've got information that I can communicate with, and I know what your wishes are, you know, we can do it in one or two consultations and we can be really safe about it. But we need to kind of just set it up in a different way. And I just, which is also why I think I mentioned to you on the phone a while back, I don't want to get everybody to be going to their GPs and saying it's my hormones, because actually I think we're going to have a greater disconnect and a greater breakup and breakdown and not move our health system forward. But if we can work together, and you know what, I'm so happy to say, I remember my first patient that said to me, I got a horrific migraine when I started testosterone. And I was like, oh, not had anyone have that yet. You know, I was like, I'm learning every day from my patients. So I think that we need to work together more, because we don't, we're not paternalistic. That kind of, that's gone. We're meant to work together, but we don't want to do things wrong as well.
Yeah, and that's the difficult thing with this, is like, it is so unique to each individual with a variety of factors, including, you know, with, you know, neurodivergence, as well as like, you know, their health background, their stress, their all sorts of different things going on in their life. Like all of that is a factor. And like you're saying, that's why the GP is such a good person to go to when they have all of that information on file and they know you.
Definitely. And it's been incredible for me, like building up relationships with women now, because I've been doing my clinic for like over 5 years, that women, I just felt there was a missing piece. And then, you know, a while later, I'm now like, my mum was admitted in a psychiatric unit at 49. And suddenly that's that piece, which, you know, if I was a GP, even if I've said, what's your family history, but a lot of people don't think ADHD, and like, you know, for me, ADHD in your children or your parents or drug addiction, they're really relevant because it just helps me support you and know what your biggest fear is. Because I also think, you know, why did a lot of people turn to drug addiction? It's often because of comorbidities or, you know, intergenerational trauma, which we need to, in midlife, and for our women who are like the rock of the fauna, we need to support that. And there's a huge fear, particularly in our Maori population, of medications and of the Western, you know, model. So we need to be able to journey along together. And I don't actually think a GP is the best person to do that, because I don't think we have the time to give all of the energy. But I think, so that's also why I think the system needs to change a bit. But we cannot just isolate menopause. We can't do that.
Oh, it's such a big... it's such a big topic. Like, it I feel is, like we could talk about this all day. But let me ask you a couple more of the questions here. Like, supplements, that is one that I get asked all the time. Are there supplements that I could take or should take when hormones begin to fluctuate? And no doubt that's going to vary depending on the hormone, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I have little things and I haven't done a deep dive into ADHD supplements. So I'm not even going to comment about that. But you know, ashwagandha, black cohosh have all got evidence for kind of mood, or black cohosh for hot flushes. So it depends what your symptoms are. But one of your last questions, which I think, you know, I think supplements can help, and we need calcium in our diet to help menstrual flow, to help muscle bulk, to help protect bone health. And the way I think of supplements is literally a supplementing. So actually, for me, calcium, if you haven't got enough calcium in your diet, you don't need to have it every day. Have it 3 times a week, or have it when you remember, or add in a calcium fortified soy milk protein shake. But actually, with supplements, if you're struggling, for the majority of cases, supplements don't cut it. You know what? Maybe supplements, like, where are you in your journey now? Because if you're really low or things are really hard, the evidence says you need some more support than just supplements. But a lot of the time, if we just go straight to hormones, hormones are the gold standard. You know, they improve hot flushes in 80 to 90%. They improve mood in 80 to 90% if used appropriately. And I think that's probably a whole nother podcast.
Oh yeah. I've had a lot of experience personally with supplements and trialing a lot of those recommended for ADHD as well as like, you know, mood related supplements and so forth. And yeah, that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
So they've got to be used appropriately. And I think you've got to set yourself up to succeed. Because it may be that hormones and medications and seeing a doctor are not where your heart is and not where you want to be. But actually, you know, I'd be like, I'd encourage you to take a step back and reflect on what are your priorities and where do you want to be? Because actually, there may be that hormones can get you there, or it may be that antidepressants can get you there. Yeah. Or it may be a quarter of an antidepressant in the luteal phase can be that where you want to be. And there's evidence for those. But don't wait until you crash. Because it's much harder then when there's no buffer. And I think a lot of the time we do get side effects from HRT. We get side effects from our menstrual cycle. We feel different all the time. So if we're putting anything in or changing anything, you're probably going to get side effects. But do you have that buffer to cope with them at that point? And a lot of individuals who are neurodivergent, then actually you don't have as much of the buffer and you're hypersensitive to these. So, you know, a lot of my kind of HRT management plans, I always call it HRT rather than MHT, just because of habits, then I start really, really low. And based on whether I do progesterone first or estrogen first and what kind of things and how do we build it up. So I think
and that makes sense for us neurodivergent people, because we are hypersensitive. Like that is one, and that means that specific things, not just our emotions, right? Like emotionally, we are hypersensitive. We feel either like devastated or like over the moon. Like we're very extreme in that way. And it's the same with things that we try, like whether that be supplements or like HRT or medication, we can have that very kind of extreme sensitive reaction. So,
I think that there are supplements, and the Australasian Menopause Society has got some good leaflets about kind of, you know, supplements, non-hormonal medication well. But also I'm really biased because people come to me when supplements aren't working.
I hear that so much. Like I've followed your work for so long and also like in other kind of menopause support groups and different things. I do a lot of research on ADHD all the time, and I'm often reading like, you know, supplements don't cut it when it comes to the hormonal element. Like, yes, they can support brain function and serotonin increases and dopamine and all of this, but you know, when hormones are really, you know, impacting your quality of life, then
and I think it's also, you know, hormones in menopause, they do actually impact your ability to sleep. One hot flush a night has shown to impact sleep quality for the whole night. And particularly if melatonin and estrogen interact too. So if you've got low estrogen, then you're going to have lower melatonin. And that's obviously, you know, in the ADHD community, more sensitive to those hormone changes as well. So I often use melatonin. I often use high doses of melatonin. So sleep's a really big thing. And then bad sleep goes to anxiety, and you often can get into cycles really quickly.
So it's looking at that whole picture, right? Like not just one thing. It's looking at the whole holistic picture of, you know, like the anxiety, the sleep, the hot flushes, all of this, and how that's impacting, you know, the lack of sleep is then increasing your, you know, your intensity of your ADHD symptoms. You're struggling to focus, like it's impacting relationships, all sorts of things.
And even like a lot of like AU-ADHD kind of overlap, you know, with the sensory awareness, I think come perimenopause, particularly if you've got young children and you've got that loss of control, often you can be like touched out. And then you're kind of, you know, you're more hypersensitive to that as well. So, you know, sometimes just using some hormones to support that or have that awareness as well. Because actually when you look really bluntly at the data for HRT in perimenopause, if the benefits outweigh the risks for you, and I think for ADHD, they may be benefits that others don't think of as being completely typical. For example, if you're so exhausted and you can't do your exercise, is that your lifestyle medication gone? If you then feel so nauseous in the mornings because of anxiety and you can't take your ADHD meds, is that your way in? Did you have huge issues with anxiety when you're a teenager that have come back completely unannounced? And that's what's driving you. So I think we've got to be really open-minded about what are these symptoms, because as soon as you know HRT decreases the risk and particularly the safest forms of HRT decrease the risk of heart disease by 50%, osteoporosis by 30%, osteoarthritis, autoimmune disease, inflammatory disease, depression, psychosis, diabetes by 30%. So yeah, and they do increase the risk of breast cancer, but that increased risk of breast cancer is equivalent or is less than being obese or having 2 units of wine a day. And look at the rates of alcoholism in perimenopausal women and high alcohol intake. So I'm really, like, I think that's one of my really big things. I'm like, I am not happy with you not having HRT if you're worried about breast cancer risk if you're having 2 glasses of wine a day. Like, that is, it's not synergistic.
Yeah. That
so
puts actually, it into perspective,
you do not
doesn't
need to
it?
Worry about, put it into perspective. You don't need to worry about that. I am not worried about it.
Yeah.
And we can mitigate that. We can look at, like, you know, if you are gaining weight because you can't exercise, then we need to support your weight management, your body composition plan.
So when we talk about HRT, though, how soon should we go onto HRT or explore that or even consider that?
Well, you know what? I think this is where we need to advocate for ourselves and, you know, reflect on. One of my arguments is if you've got a teenager or someone in the 20s that says, my periods are awful, I, doesn't, you know, I don't even explore what awful is. Oh, I want to go on the pill. Done. Okay. Right. Bye. That's it. You know, you can get the pill from the pharmacist. So if your periods are bothersome, then actually, and particularly if you notice those bi-monthly peaks and troughing symptoms, then actually that's a clue. So monitor that. Is it worsening? Is it manageable? I am really mindful, though, that I think when you've constantly got either a shortened cycle, so if your cycle is 21 days instead of 28, then you're going to have a much smaller gap between these peaks and troughs. So you almost lose a bit of a buffer. So for some women I see that they're like, nah, flat all the time, no energy. I'm like, okay, well, actually in my mind, I'm like, I say to them, you know, it may be that we've lost this buffer in this cyclical pattern. So it's still worthwhile exploring, but these are clues that often, you know, demonstrate to me hormones may be beneficial. And often then I find women go home and they reflect on it and they're like, oh yeah, actually this was a really hard time in my life because I don't really care about diagnoses. I'm like, let's just figure how you fit together. And you tell me about you, and then I'll just kind of try and make it work.
Yeah, and to speak to the to that, it was something that I'm considering, and I think I'm very well. I assume I'm very young to consider going on HRT.
Not in my clinic.
Really? Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Like, I don't have, like, I don't have really bad periods. I don't experience PMDD, and I must admit that I now that I eat like very clean, like I cut out. You know, I cut out sugar years ago and, you know, don't have a lot of gluten. And I just try and stick to whole foods. That makes a huge impact on not only my ADHD symptoms, but also on my periods. I used to have awful, painful, horrible periods, like nasty. And it's not like that now. But at the same time, like the emotional fluctuation and the mood fluctuation that I can notice is definitely intensified hugely. And that for me is why I was like, well, if this new ADHD medication doesn't support me more in that realm, then it is something that I might consider.
You know what? I'm just going to be devil's advocate and say, what are the risks and benefits of ADHD meds compared to hormones? I'm very pro appropriate use of stimulants. So it's not I'm against it. But actually, what are the, obviously the benefits of stimulants, you know, engagement, brain cognition, decreases the risk of comorbidities and stuff. But actually, if you can have less stimulants and some hormones, what's the...
Well, the interesting thing is, like, I asked my psychiatrist about this and he said, yeah, you can do both. Like, it's completely fine, right?
Both,
but if I was to, if I was to explore the option of, like, the hormones and move off medication and perhaps even just use... No?
Well, why would you if you feel better? But I think that actually, for me, it would be... Like, why would I give someone antidepressants when potentially if they can have hormone treatment and it's clearly perimenopausal mood changes or why on earth would I give them antidepressants? Yeah, it would help their mood, but HRT would improve a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, like the medication that I'm currently on, I did a lot of research on it, my ADHD medication that is, and it, there are a lot of studies. Well, there was a huge study done rather on women, not ADHD women, but women who in midlife during perimenopause and menopause were really struggling with symptoms, and it helped specifically with their symptoms. And so that is the one that I'm currently on. I've only been on it for a few months, so still learning. But that was a big factor in why I advocated for that one specifically, was to see if it could help kind of level things out more. Like instead of the huge, the continuous emotional roller coaster. And it has been incredibly beneficial in that,
So validating.
like I can now get my brain is calm for the first time ever. Like I've never experienced this. I literally cried when I told my psychiatrist, my brain is calm. Like, what the actual F is going on? Like, but it helps because, right, I can use all of my tools. I can help to soothe my emotions and do all these other things that manage my stress much better when I can get control of what's happening up there. So it's hugely beneficial. And I was like, could it even be better? Like, if I was to have estrogen as well, like,
Yeah, I don't know. I think
right?
that the clues would be one is the clues would be, is it worth premenstrual? And is it worsening? What else is going on? Looking at the physical symptoms as well. Do you get like a bit of a peak at mid-cycle? Because so for HRT and the perimenopause, it's tiny doses compared to what our hormones are actually doing. So I talk about it being a bit of a buffer. Like, so it's not going to override stuff.
No.
But
But that's so helpful, even just hearing you say that, because I know a lot of people will relate to like my experience and what I'm sharing, but just hearing you say, like, even just try it, like,
yeah,
why
why
just
not?
try it? Why not? Like, you can stop taking it, right? Or you can say, go back to your GP and say, hey, this was my experience of it. This is what I've noticed. Is there something that would be better suited?
And I used to think that once people are on it, they're on it forever. And I don't think that anymore because I think you don't need to be. It may be helpful, and I don't have a problem with that, or at least until menopause. But why can't you use it if you've had a few challenging years in your late 30s and then not again until you're 49? I don't think it matters. It's about what's right for you and having the tools to be able to adapt that.
Oh, so good to hear that. Okay. So tell us then, like, if we are noticing, challenges or changes with our hormones and we want some help, when do we get help? Where should we go? How can we best prepare for that?
Oh, I think it depends on like what who's in your community. Like who can you talk to? Talk to your friends, who's got information, reflect on your own experience. There's like the Monash, the Her Women Centre is kind of getting out more and more stuff, which is really cool about brain function and mental health with hormones. And Louise Newson's a great resource as well. But
Which
it is
one
a
was that?
Louise Newson's podcast.
Oh, yes.
So it's about kind of, I think, extracting the little bits and looking at the wider diagnoses. So looking at the resources for PMDD, looking at some of the resources for autism, looking at some of the resources for ADHD, because there'll be an overlap and there'll be things that are tools and tricks that you may gain from that area of, from that area of knowledge, that body of knowledge. I think being open-minded with your doctor, and working together, and you'll get whether they're engaged, whether they want to learn, and also I think set yourself up and go in prepared that they might criticize you, because what with the RSD, we don't want it to be all over because it can be really hard. Like make sure one of your friends knows you're going, feel confident in what you've got to say, but actually don't go in feeling that you need to have an argument. Go in to be like, these are my thoughts, can we work together? And because and I think bear in mind one of the things is that actually the a GP's concern is going to be, are they missing anything, and what's the time? Because that's what's bounding us, not necessarily to our wishes, but if you're acknowledging the time and saying, I can come back and discuss this with you, I can
Or
pay for an
even
email
like,
consult,
book a
then
double appointment if you are worried about the time. Like, book a longer, ask, can I book a double appointment, please? Because I don't want to be worried about the time. Like, I think that's where we can start to even advocate for ourselves.
And then probably when over the next few weeks when my course is done, I'll be like, do my course and set
Definitely.
yourself up.
We'll point people in that direction. But in the interim, like, there is the, so what I just want to recap hearing you say is, like, speak to your community. So to, you know, do talk about it with your friends and the people that you feel safe in which to do so, because, oh, we get the thumb on the screen. But that helps to, understand that, you know, you're not alone. Other people are going through this.
Does it work?
No thumb for you. I don't know what I've got.
I wanted to try it.
I'm sitting on my Zoom and sometimes I can release balloons and I don't know how I do it yet. The thumb is really easy, but the balloons is like, I don't know. Anyway. So talking to your community, that sounds really important. You know, and then I think also researching, like having a bit of an understanding and gathering some information so that you can, you know, talk about the symptoms or the things that you're experiencing and think outside of just
Look
at other things.
The app Fitter Woman, have you seen that?
What's that?
Fitter Woman, the app, F-I-T-R Woman.
No, I haven't. So, I'll write it down.
Yeah, pop a link on your website. So that's when I've got women that are starting to understand about the cycle changes, I direct them to that. Because you put in where your period is, and it talks about like you, it says like, this is the follicular phase, this is the nutrition you need, this is what your immune response is, this is what my... you might feel like, so it can just help. It's not a neurodiversifying app, but it helps, I think, with
help
the foundation.
You understand. Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, we'll definitely link to that. But that's a big piece of it, right, is like the wider understanding and not just kind of focusing tunnel vision on this one thing.
Yeah.
And then like advocating for yourself. Like that is something I say to people all the time when they're, you know, going through the process of their ADHD diagnosis. And I think it's the same again here. It's like, we've got to advocate for ourselves, especially when, you know, GPs may be afraid of the conversation or they may not be as knowledgeable as we would like, you know, we've got to go in and advocate for ourselves. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I love it. Is there anything, I know we've talked for so long, is there anything you feel like we haven't discussed that's important that you want to add?
Well, there's always stuff I can talk about, but that's probably like, bugger, No, I think that's probably, I probably need to go back to work.
So. Yeah, we'll let you do that. Thank you so, so much. Like, this conversation has been amazing. I have learned so much and I know that, you know, everyone who listens to it is really going to benefit so much. And we're going to link to all of the resources that you've mentioned in the show notes so that people can click on those and find them easy. Thank you so much, Samantha.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
If you are loving what you're learning here on the podcast, but you still feel like your ADHD is holding you back, I can help. Using evidence-based coaching tools and my own experiences, I'll help you to manage your emotions and feel better, to increase your productivity, grow your self-confidence, and create the life that you were meant for. Visit zenajones.com/thrive and schedule an ADHD support session to get started.